This is Justin Miller for KBOO News and Public Affairs. I'm pleased to be joined today by author, commenter, and poet, Mr. Calvin Trillin. Mr. Trillin has written for The New Yorker, The Nation, Time Magazine, has appeared on National Public Radio, and is accused by some accounts of authoring as many as 56 books. Mr. Trillin writes on politics, on food, and in his latest installment of political poetry, A Heck of a Job, Mr. Trillin continues his experiment at bringing down a presidency through iambic pentameter. Calvin Trillin, welcome.
Thanks very much.
Now, certainly the left is no stranger to your commentary, but it seems your political verse has attracted quite a bit of attention. Do people prefer your opinions when they rhyme? I mean, are you finding yourself getting any more traction in verse?
I think a lot of people don't like them, no matter what form they're in. I think you can say some things in verse that you can't say in prose. It sort of takes the sting out a little bit. For instance, we had a senator in New York named Alphonse D'Amato, who was called the most corrupt man in the Senate regularly, particularly by Sidney Schanberg in Newsday. And his name was hard to rhyme, D'Amato. People said you could rhyme it with tomato, but I'm from Kansas City, and I just couldn't bear to say tomato. And then I finally realized it rhymed with sleazeball obligato. That's something I probably wouldn't say in prose about Alphonse D'Amato, true or not.
So there's permission. You give yourself a permission in verse that you might not.
Yeah, I think if it rhymes, it tends to be more acceptable than if it doesn't rhyme. Hmm.
I was thinking of clamato, as in the best Bloody Mary, but...
Clamato is clamato. Well, see, we would probably say clamato. I guess clamato is clamato, isn't it?
Well, now, I heard Willie Nelson say recently that he never told jokes on stage because he was afraid that if he stopped singing, everybody would leave. They didn't come to hear him tell jokes. In that spirit, rather than hear me ask questions, I'd really rather use the time to have you read what struck me as a real magnum opus, and that's The War in Nine Stanzas.
I'd be happy to. I thought you were going to say, in that spirit, you wanted me to sing. But this is a poem. This is one of the poems in the book that didn't appear in The Nation, where most of them are from. It appeared in the op-ed page of the New York Times on August 15th, 2004. Stanza one, it's called The War in Nine Stanzas. One, we chose in this millennium's first test between two lesser heirs who at their best, if they'd been born as sons of other pops, might hope to be elected sheriff, tops. At school, Bush was a dunce, there's no denying. Young Gore did not stand out, and he was trying. A frat house honcho, Bush reprised that part. Young Gore portrayed a piece of chainsaw art. In Florida, the fate of these two lads appeared for days to hang on hanging chads. 'Twas Tilden Hayes that put one in the mind of, and then at last the Bush heir won, or kind of. Two. When job and Wall Street numbers both declined, the pundits in the Capitol opined, if Bush the second doesn't watch his step, he is going to be a second one-term preppy. And then, as many briefers have predicted, Bin Laden and his terrorists inflicted a mighty blow with our own planes they smote us. At first the president seemed not to notice, while reading to a class he didn't quit when told the second tower had been hit. Befuddlement was on his face writ large. Then someone must have said, "Sir, you're in charge." 3. Though nothing showed Iraq had played a part, that's where some hawks thought vengeance ought to start. Then terrorists could count on what we'd do. Attack us, we'll strike back, though not at you. We toppled first that band of Afghan loonies who'd let Bin Laden hide out in their boonies. The Taliban were smashed in one fell swoop. Bin Laden, though, had plainly flown the coop. Bush then forgot that name and said, in fact, Iraq's the place that has to be attacked. The war, Rove thought, with this one course correction, could still endure until the next election. 4. Bush said that our security was based on getting this Saddam erased post-haste. In crimes, Saddam's CV was hardly lacking, though that was true when he'd enjoyed our backing. But now we had these weapons we'd forbidden, the White House said we knew that where they were hidden. One saw Saddam Hussein, George Bush implied, behind that awful day our people died. And therefore Condoleezza Rice allowed the next attack might be a mushroom cloud. Yes, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Colin Powell, too, said lots of things they had to know weren't true. 5. To war, the neoconish hawks all said, they'd nested in the space in Bush's head. Saddam was Hitler, circa 39, they said. It's up to us to draw the line. Though they'd been draft evaders to a man, they talked as tough as cowpokes in Cheyenne. Iraq will greet our boys and girls with petals, Hawks said, and when the dust of warfare settles, Iraq will pay the reconstruction bill, and one by one the Arab countries will democratize as fast as they are able, like dominoes that snap up from the table. 6. For us to fight to right what needed righting was right, they said, though others did the fighting. As power for the good, we were exempt from rules of war. The U.S. could preempt old allies who did not see things our way, were soon dismissed as weasels or passé. While making fun of duped U.N. inspectors, Hawks brandished facts from Chalabi's defectors. And so we conquered Baghdad and the rest, as Bush would on a flight deck soon attest. He wore his flight suit for that panorama, the suit he hadn't used in Alabama. 7. But what we'd set to writing went so wrong it stirred some memories of the Viet Cong. Unduped inspectors came to realize that Chalabi had fed us lies. Surprise. There never was a flower petal shower. They saw us as an occupying power. While we paid Cheney's cronies to rebuild, Iraqis cheered to see our soldiers killed. Insurgent forces and our troops still battled as Jerry Bremer and his crew skedaddled. For them, Bush spun the spin that he could muster, the sort of speech last used for praising Custer. 8. With kidnappings and bombings on the rise, our partners started saying their goodbyes. And even Colin Powell has now confessed the coalition seems less coalesced. The older allies we had roundly dissed declined our invitation to assist. No domino snapped up as hopeful token the Middle East is fixed. It seems more broken. More U.S. hatred than before. More anti-U.S. hatred than before. More fresh recruits to fight a holy war. In Europe, though, most people take the view the danger's not from Muslims, but Bush too. 9. The weapons that we went to war to get have not, as Bush might say, been found just yet. And even Bush no longer seeks to blame Iraq for when the towers were aflame. You needn't have clairvoyance to intuit the war's against a man who didn't do it. The man who did is laughing up his sleeve, as parents of our fallen soldiers grieve. Although we live in color-coded dread, the war has made us safer, Bush has said. Most voters like the way he's fought the terror, and Bush, when asked, could not recall one error. Since then, as you know, Justin, I'm sure, Bush has acknowledged a kind of a minor mistake in his language, that he shouldn't have used words like bring them on or dead or alive. And I wrote a poem about that a couple of weeks ago, which was called Bush's Ask Again If He Can Recall Any Mistakes. Mistakes? Bush now admits that bring them on was not too shrewd. He said so quite contritely. Such cowboy talk, he says, he'll use no more. He'll still start wars, of course, but more politely.
Fantastic. You know, it strikes me, in one sense, you're doing such high art with words like dist, and right. Also the rhyme, the meter. I mean, I'm certainly no expert, but to to fight to write what needed writing. The meter is really good, and it seems to me that it is also very accessible. You know, it's taking a form that is easily dismissed, as you said earlier, that it gives you permission to say things you might not otherwise say. I think it perhaps gives a reader permission to read things they might not otherwise read.
Well, I hope so. I rhyming things is a sort of minor facility that I sometimes compare with the guy in every family who's able to bend his thumb back and touch his wrist or something like that. And it may be genetic. My father was a rhymester. My father was a grocer most of his working life, but for a few years he had a restaurant, and at lunchtime every day he put a poem, or really a rhyming couplet, on the menu. Usually they were about pie. The shortest one, I believe, was "Don't Sigh, Eat Pie." But he rhymed pie with "Evening is Nigh" and "All right, warden, I'm ready to fry. I've had my last piece of Mrs. Trillin's pie," that sort of thing. And the dedication of this book says, "In memory of Abe Trillin, whose fondness for rhyme and disdain for meter led him to write such couplets as, 'Eat your food,' gently said Mom to little son Roddy. 'If you don't, I will break every bone in your body.'"
Well, you seem to be fulfilling your destiny, as it were.
Yes, I'm a second-generation poet.
Now, as I'm reading through these poems, it seemed to me that it was really a wonderful cabaret review of the last 6 years of American politics, and it was struck me as not just a collection of poems, but really a sort of political and cultural history for posterity. But I also liked you revealed a few theories that you hold, and I thought maybe you might tell listeners about it. For example, you had an interesting idea about Richard Reed, the erstwhile shoe bomber.
The so-called shoe bomber, yeah. Well, my theory, this came out when I gave a little talk at the Brooklyn Public Library a few months after 9/11, and somebody said to me, "Are you worried about flying so much after 9/11? And I said, "What worries me is you have to show your identification so much. I'm afraid I'll lose my driver's license and have to go down there." And you might say that I fear the New York State Department of Motor Vehicles more than I fear Arab terrorism. But the other way I've managed to fly happily is I have some views on terrorism probably aren't shared by some of the terrorism experts. The biggest windbags on television, by the way. I mean, the minute it says terrorism expert, I say, here we go. I mean, these guys, the credentials, I think, do not bear scrutiny. But at any rate, they say Reed was the real thing. But I read about him, and one of the things that I read was that the people in his mosque kept describing him as extraordinarily impressionable, and that you could kind of persuade him to do anything. My theory is that there's one. And then I don't know if you read about the details, but he was such a goofball when he's trying to do that. I mean, he made such a production of lighting his shoes. He practically asked the flight attendant for a match. He had stuff hanging off of the fuses and all that. So it seemed to me not a really shrewdly put together plot. And my theory was that there's one terrorist with a sense of humor in London. I call him Khalid the Droll, and he said to the other guys in the cell after they were sitting around, I guess they don't have beer, but after they were sitting around over bitter tea one night, and said, "I bet I can get those Americans to take their shoes off in airports."
Right, the practical joke.
Yeah, so he set up poor Reed, Khalid the Droll did, and and now he's cackling over there. And you'll know if my theory is correct when you see somebody caught and identified as the underwear bomber.
I was going to ask you to point out that you'd even come up with a metric to determine whether this theory...
Exactly. That will do it. If you see the underwear bomber caught, you'll know I'm on to something.
Now, not only do you have some wonderful theories here, but you also report that you sometimes cheer yourself up with a particular fantasy about Mr. Cheney, the current vice president. I wonder if you'd comment on that.
Yeah, sometimes on a gray afternoon when I'm trying to cheer myself up, I imagine Cheney being snatched off the street by a black ops squad from the Sierra Club and rendered, as they say, to a country whose methods would be considered torture, even by Alberto Gonzalez.
Which is saying something.
It is saying something because, you know, his name, as I have proven in this book, rhymes with loyal Uber Alles. Asked to name the members of the Energy Task Force. I actually wrote a poem on that subject a couple of weeks ago, which isn't in the book. It was too late for the book. That's called Cheney at the Pump. When it behooved Dick Cheney to devise a policy on energy, some guys in oil with whom Dick Cheney has close ties all gathered at the White House to advise. Presumably, they showed up in disguise. Their names, though fairly easy to surmise, were kept by Dick more secret than some spies. So as the price of gas achieves new highs and cries from all the working folks arise, these very guys upon whom Dick relies, the good oil boys he sought to deputize, the ones from whom our policy derives, are making out like bandits profit-wise. Surprise, 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 surprise.
Yeah, that's particularly your line about keeping these names closer than some spy. So that seems...
Yeah, that is the work of the man I call in this book. I have two nicknames for him. I'm afraid I've taken on George W. Bush's tendency to give nicknames, and it's crept up on me without knowing it. And I call him sometimes Five Deferments Dick, and... sometimes when I'm talking about his caregiving role in the White House, Nanny Dick.
Well, let's stay with Nanny Dick for just a minute. I'm wondering if you would share with us watching Dick Cheney in debate.
Sure. It might take me...
Page 35.
Well, that's good. That's like the minister who knows where the hymn is. I'm glad to hear that.
Such as it is.
Such as it is, right. Watching Dick Cheney in debate... I must say this, in studying Dick Cheney, the man betrays no impulse to be zany, resembling in his scowl and condescendence the stern vice principal who checks attendance. He plants himself, in fact, I think it's fair to say he seems stuck firmly to his chair. He growls his answers in the sort of tone you hear from bill collectors on the phone. And when he tells a whopper, like denying that he has gone around this land, implying Ray 9/11 that Saddam's Iraq was mixed up in that awful sneak attack, he seems so certain of his point of view, you almost think that what he said is true. At any time now, goes his favorite thesis, Chicago could get blasted all to pieces. So his looks hard enough for stones to glance off, as he drones on and tries to scare our pants off.
Now, let me ask you, Mr. Trillin, I've heard comedians, excuse me, particularly in venues such as Saturday Night Live, for example, say that a two-term presidency gives time to perfect the mocking. So I guess despite the damage, the killing, the crime done by a second term here, is there any little bit of joy at all in having the extra material that a second term provides?
Are you trying to say, do I feel guilty about knowing that this sort of silver lining is available to me? we feel about that stuff, people in my line of work, people who make a living making snide, underhanded remarks about respectable public servants. I'm often asked if I'm ashamed to make a living that way, and my only real defense is it's not much of a living. But we feel the way dentists feel about tooth decay. It's a pity, but where would business be without it?
That's a good answer.
I actually think if 9/11 hadn't happened, that we wouldn't have required two terms to get to where we are now. I think Bush would have been at the 30% approval rating in the third year, and we would have perfected all of our imitations and the cast of characters hasn't really changed that much, you know. We're getting some new people now, but basically people like Condoleezza Rice was already here. Cheney, Alberto Gonzalez was there, and Harriet Myers even. I have a cheer, by the way, for Harriet Myers.
I was actually going to ask you to comment on Harriet Myers.
Well, I did a cheer. I did both a cheer for her, and I did a poem. I did a poem about the opposition to her by people on the right. The president who never tires of naming cronies named Miss Myers to be a justice. I'm not kidding. He said he knows she'll do his bidding. The social issues right went crazy. They called her record much too hazy. Though through the code, with some contortion, Bush signaled that she hates abortion. They asked, so why is she not willing to say right out it's baby killing? Responding to this strong attack, he assured the right she's really wacky. In phone calls rove, in hopes of winning, support from preachers gave this spinning. It's by her church that ye shall know her. Her church is low, no church is lower. Her church friends, please think holy rollers, treat embryos like kids in strollers, including embryos of rapists. The Baptists to these folks are papists. She's not the moderate you deem her. If you're extreme, then she's extremer. Her style is not to be dramatic, but be assured she is fanatic. Well, I sort of felt for Harriet Myers. They accused her of almost everything from mediocre lawyering to unfortunate eyeliner. And so I did a cheer for her. I try to come to people's defense. It's not true that I have no empathy. Who's willing to draw water for George Bush and carry it? Harriet. Who worked to take his DWI rap and bury it? Harriet. Who thinks anyone critical of him is Judas Iscariot? Still Harriet. Rah, rah, rah.
I'm speaking today with humorist and raconteur Mr. Calvin Trillin. You know, I thought that there was one refreshing element of the Harriet Myers saga, if it even rises to that level. It seemed to me that this was one case of the Republicans finally being honest, and that was that there is a litmus test. They weren't sure she passed it. And in a frustrating way, I found that very refreshing. At least we no longer have to hear this tripe about how there is no litmus test.
Right. A litmus test is what your opponents have for the Supreme Court. Nobody who's actually in power has a litmus test. Litmus test is available only to people on the other side. So
that's the metric, then.
It is the metric. And in fact, there's no reason not to have a litmus test. I mean, the Constitution says that the president, with the advice and consent of the Senate, can name a candidate, and why wouldn't he name somebody who believed what he believed? I mean, I think the big shuck on Supreme Court nominations is the notion that some people are strict constructionist and some people aren't, and that's the difference. That is not the difference. I mean, if anybody had ever believed that, Bush v. Gore should have put that belief to rest. But the difference between the judges that Bush names and some of the judges that Clinton names is not that they are strict constructionists or not strict constructionists. Breyer, in fact, has, I believe, by one view, been the most strict constructionist, in that he is less likely to say that something is unconstitutional that the legislature does. The real difference is that the Bush judges are generally on the side of corporations, executive power. They're conservatives, and the litmus test and the business about original intent. I mean, when Scalia actually said about Bush v. Gore, he said, "Well, it had the Supreme Court really had to put an end to it."
How could we not take this case?
Yeah, and we had to take an end to it. But where is the original intent about putting an end to things? I mean, there's nothing like that. It's very simple. They did what they say activist judges do, which is they decided the outcome they wanted, and they found some reason to get there. And they even said in the decision, it's not to be taken as a precedent. So,
right. Further down the rabbit hole we go. Now, like the president, you went to Yale. I won't ask your GPA.
Right. I did better than the president.
That was going
to
be my guess.
Not to speak of Cheney. My theory about how Cheney got on the ticket as vice president, other than he named himself, is that he was the only living American politician who had a less distinguished academic record at Yale than George Bush. He flunked out.
Well, unlike the president and the vice president, if I'm not mistaken, you served in the military.
Yes, I was quite brave. Unfortunately for me, it was peacetime. And otherwise, I think I would have probably gotten maybe not the Medal of Honor, but certainly the Distinguished Service Cross. Well, maybe a Silver Star. Silver Star is very good. That's what Kerry got, I think. And you have to do some great. My only real action was that I landed on a helicopter from Staten Island to Governor's Island with the some other soldiers and captured the incinerator from a group of IBM clerks in a demonstration for Armed Forces Day open house.
Were you in a flight suit?
I was not in a flight suit, but I was in combat uniform, which is odd because I never actually learned to shoot the rifle because the company clerk in my basic training unit was interested in having somebody do his typing for him, and I happened to type very well. So
not quite the Champagne Brigade, but...
No, it was not the Champagne Brigade. There's actually a poem in here that's not very funny about somebody who couldn't get into the Champagne unit of the Texas Air National Guard and was killed in Vietnam. A hypothetical person. I think one thing about being in the Army, even in peacetime, is that there's certain things that you can't possibly believe. That is, if people said the people in Abu Ghraib prison were dangerous threats to security of Iraq, if you've been in the Army, that notion is just laughable. And that is true even of Guantanamo, because you know that some of them are there because they mouthed off to an MP at a checkpoint. You know, some of them are there because the captain of one unit said, people are expecting us to find 10 of these guys this week, and we've only found 6.
I was just thinking the quota system.
And that's the way the Army works. And that's why there are these arguments about medals, because a lot of medals go that way. We need a certain number of medals, and so we found this guy. I mean, anybody who's been in the Army has to know that anything on paper is probably not true. It started out with what was needed to be on the paper and then worked backwards. So the idea that the people in Guantanamo are all the worst of the worst and would blow up the world if we let them go, or God forbid, gave them a trial or let them see a lawyer or anything like that. It's just laughable. You can't possibly take it seriously.
I'm sensing a theme, not unlike the Bush v. Gore results, that you have a result and let's work backward.
No, exactly. Exactly. I think that's an awful lot of decisions are made that way. I mean, and lawyers will tell you, trial lawyers, that often juries decide that way. They decide whether they want to call the guy guilty or not guilty, and then they find a reason, or whether they want to award somebody $1 million or not award them $1 million, and then they find a reason. That's how human beings make decisions often.
Well, I wonder, as we finish up our discussion of the military, if you might not read for us Not Wounded Enough on page 37?
Not Wounded Enough is, let me get it here. Sorry, here we go. Republicans say Kerry might have got some wounds, but not the kind that hurt a lot. Their own man cannot ever be accused of claiming wounds when he was bruised. He might have gotten banged up in that summer he was skipping all those meetings in Montgomery, but slipping on some beer while chasing booty is not considered in the line of duty.
Now, as we start to enter, it seems a wonder that we ever get any time outside of the election cycle. But I'm curious, as we look towards the next regime, do you have a favorite Democratic leader from the perspective of your verse? Who's got the most comedic potential on the Democratic side? And I'm assuming that Lieberman doesn't count, right?
You mean he doesn't count because he's not a Democrat, actually?
Well, nor is he funny. So
he's not a lot of laughs, Senator Lieberman. But not many senators are funny, and or not many politicians are funny, and I think Adlai Stevenson was a good example of what happens to a funny politician. I mean, right. it's not a good thing to be. Irony is, it's an irony-free zone, generally. Although John Kennedy was often funny, and Lyndon Johnson, in an extremely crude way, was funny. But it's unusual. I have a sort of a selfish feeling about this. For instance, I was telling someone from Massachusetts today, I was asked about Mitt Romney, and I said, I'm opposed to him on rhyming grounds.
Well, and that's exactly what I'm
Romney's not a good name for me, and it's as bad as Clinton, almost. And John McCain is a good name.
You could get a lot of mileage.
And in fact, I think there's a poem in the previous book, Obliviously On He Sails, that is about John McCain, that is entirely the Ain. Everything rhymes with McCain. That's called a monorhyme. I learned that from Billy Collins, what my family calls a grown-up poet, who actually knows this sort of thing. So if you imagine trying to write a monorhyme about Bush, which rhymes only really with tush, which is disrespectful. And Clinton was very bad.
Well, and as we look down the road, I have to assume you have a mixed feelings about Obama. I mean, I see one easy one, but after that, it starts to get a little thin.
Exactly. After that, you have some problems. I'm opposed to him. Ross Perot was my candidate in '92, the rare iambic candidate with an O rhyme, which is an excellent rhyme. I mean, he's a little bit.
And he was funny.
He was funny, a little squirrely, but funny. Yeah, that's true. Actually, I really appreciate what he did after he went to the Naval Academy. In Texarkana, his family's name was Piro, and this man of the people, this humble, just folks guy, decided, I think, that it didn't sound fancy enough. It's true, Piro sounds like you might hear the sheriff say to one of his deputies, you better get out to the do drop in tonight. A bunch of them Piros are out there. You know how they get late in the evening. So Ross Perot was good. I liked him. There's a poem in there about the president's father, the first President Bush, and because of the way he's lacking in rhyme ability, I had, fortunately, he has a bunch of middle names, so I did a poem when he left that was "Farewell to you, George Herbert Walker. Though never treasured as a talker, your predicates were often prone to wander nounless off alone. You did your best in your own way, the way of Greenwich Country Day. So just relax, take your ease, and never order Japanese." I get sort of sentimental when they leave.
Well, that's actually reminiscent I think it had to do with Mr. Keeler's Earl's Academy of Accents and how right. Mr. Bush had been spending too much time in Connecticut, and right. but after only 6 weeks in Earl's Academy of Accents.
Oh, we managed to get a Texas accent. Right. Well, you know, I wrote an introduction to one of the books that Jacob Weisberg at Slate puts out every so often on Bushisms, and I guess it was the latest one. And I offered as a theory about the problems with the language that both Bushes have, which really can't be a matter of intelligence. I mean, the first Bush, George H.W. Bush, was Phi Beta Kappa at Yale. My theory comes from a poem I wrote some years ago that says something like that they have the same problems with language, and the couplet is, they both employ the nounless predicate. This sort of thing can happen. Can get caused by cowboy boots to people from Connecticut. I mean, my theory is that their feet were born for topsiders. And when they tried to put them into cowboy boots, it caused a lot of language problems. You know that old theory that some people who stammer because they were left-handed people who their parents tried to make right-handed and that kind of thing. So this is a pretty scientific theory. I mean, for me, it's a very scientific theory.
Well, I wouldn't expect anything less. Would you share with us briefly a summary of remarks by George W. Bush and Dick Cheney on the third anniversary of the invasion of Iraq? That's page 72.
Yeah, we have a lot of anniversary stuff here. "Our strategy for peace there is really working well. It's just that all the killing can make that hard to tell."
That, to me, had an elegance. Mm. And we started the interview, you were talking about that perhaps verse allows you to say things that you might not say in prose, but it also strikes me that that's an example of how you can say things so briefly with such profundity that it would be difficult to make that argument in prose just so simply.
Well, it's true that verse, that sometimes that the point is to cut out as many words as you can and get it as short as you can. I think the shortest poem I ever wrote was something called, I think the title was long. It was something like "The Societal and Sociological and Political Implications of the O.J. Simpson Trial and the American People." And the poem itself was, "O.J., oy vey."
Well, that's not quite as short as Fleas, though, right? Isn't that still considered the world's shortest poem?
Yeah, I think so. Ogden Nash had a brief one, which was "The Bronx, no thanks."
Now, I'm speaking today with author and humorist Mr. Calvin Trillin. Of course, I could sit here for hours with you. But I imagine you have other places to be. I would point out, you know, because I was enjoying both the, as I said, the cabaret review of the last 6 years, but also you're dealing with issues that are changing day to day. We've already heard a couple of poems that are too late for this book. Mm. And I was thinking about under the heading of Revolving Door, now Jon Snow is out and Paulson of Goldman Sachs is in.
That's right.
You have a poem on the reappointment of Jon Snow.
Yes.
It seems to me we can't print the books fast enough to keep your poems timely, but we could give it our best shot. That's page 50, would you?
Well, the Random House was great about this. I think the latest poem in this book was dated in April or something, which is pretty late. But
I noticed that, and I did think that must have been really difficult. They're calling you up every day, and you're saying, no, a couple more.
Exactly. Yeah. That's pretty much the way it happened. This one, I think it's also a mono rhyme. This gives you some idea of what I've been able to do if Ross Perot had been elected. On the reappointment of Jon Snow as Secretary of the Treasury, the people in the know said Snow was someone who would have to go. The dollar's at an all-time low. On Wall Street, numbers fail to grow, and jobs have not begun to flow enough to help the average Joe. The White House leakers weren't gung-ho. On Snow, they called him just so-so, a schmo who operates below a level that is apropos for one whose job it is to know just how to make the markets glow. But as Snow packed his portmanteau, the White House said he'd undergo a second four-year term, although it might be nice to help our dough and mitigate the debt we owe and take the market to, not fro. Big changes we will now forego. It's loyalty Snow has to show. Snow says he thinks like Bush and Co. The taxing rich folks is de trop. Unlike O'Neill, he won't say no to economic schemes they throw his way. He's Bush's fiscal hoe. So maybe we'll see Bush bestow in one more night is day tableau a freedom medal on Jon Snow.
And once again, we see the use of modern vernacular combined with ancient structures.
You're referring to fiscal hoe.
I think I am.
I'm not sure that that phrase has ever been used in poetry before. Well, I'm not here to boast, of course, Justin, but it may be a first.
Now, as we wind up here, I mean, I had a list of so many poems, but I think it would be treasonous if I didn't ask you, is there a personal favorite of yours that we haven't covered, one that you feel we would be incomplete without?
I'm not sure about personal favorite, but well, there's another mono rhyme about Dick Cheney. I like poems about Cheney. It's called "On the Revelation That Dick Cheney Requires the Television to Be Preset to Fox News in Any Hotel Room He Is About to Occupy."
Excellent choice.
The networks give Bush knocks or mocks. They paint him stubborn as an ox and clever as a box of rocks, so set the channel, please, to Fox. Some commentators on the box like making us the laughing stocks, upon foul PBS, a pox, just set the channel, please, to Fox. That CNN will broadcast crocs on Arabs managing our docks, and deaths and wars and other shocks, now set the channel, please, to Fox. For me, the news that really rocks confirms beliefs held by our flocks. My mind remains quite closed with locks. So set the channel, please, to Fox.
That's fantastic. Now, by way of saying thanks, and at the risk of being something of a 22 mind in a 357 setting here, would you indulge me for just a moment with a brief limerick of my own?
I'd love to hear it, Justin. I was hoping you would come up with some poetry. I consider it my part in raising the cultural level of the program.
Even if only by a bit.
Right.
When politicians lie and cheat with crimes against our nation, There must be something to be done short of defenestration. The truth demands to be spoken, a tad would be most thrillin'. Make mine a bit of master verse from the incomparable Calvin Trillin.
Thank you.
My guest today has been author, poet, and man about town, Mr. Calvin Trillin. His latest collection of the Bush administration in rhyme is A Heck of a Job. Calvin Trillin, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
For KBOO News and Public Affairs, this is Justin Miller.